That's Jamaica's Monty Alexander and the Harlem Kingston Express with Scamento, a combination of two very well-known musical forms in Jamaica, ska and mento. This is from his 2012 album, The River Rolls On. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. What a day we agree to have today, I tell you. Well, Donald Trump has released his preliminary budget, which is quite daunting, but not unexpectedly so. I mean, we kind of got that message early on that as part of his very draconian ways of doing things, he would take a hefty axe against programs that particularly in this budget take aim at programs that support the poor in particular. As much to be said about the budget, but first I got to wade through it. It's quite extensive, but these are just preliminary programs. You just got to remember that. This is his preliminary budget. And, of course, it will have to go through its own permutations in Congress, where people are going to vote against it, or vote for further cuts or to amend the budget items that he has listed. But so don't get frazzled. It's just a preliminary budget, and it should be seen as such until hopefully there'll be quite a fight about this. But that brings us to where we have been for a while in recent weeks, talking about where's the opposition? Where's the opposition going to come from? We don't know. And we don't know how effective any opposition, particularly by the Democrats, will be. If there is going to be opposition to this budget, it will come from the people, where, at least for this administration, that is where the battle has always been waged. It's the people, the Democrats, and even within the ranks of the Republican Party, you have some resistance, which is notable, and Donald Trump will continue to have some resistance there. He is not universally loved within the Republican Party. But the pitiful response uniformly from the Democrats leads one to believe that the matter of the budget is going to be no different. They'll put up some kind of a nominal fight. But I don't know to what degree they can significantly turn this budget around or specific items on the budget around. We'll have to see. But in the meantime, again, the budget is a preliminary budget. It will have to go through its permutations, and that would include some degree of opposition, one hopes, by the Democrats. And certainly I think we will see opposition by outside forces, you know, the advocacy groups, the public interest groups. They've already begun to gear up for this fight. But we are looking at yet another instance of a kind of self-induced impotence by the Democratic Party in the face of really dire circumstances, that the party seems unable to corral and muster up the necessary support for its version of policies and practices that the Trump administration has been enacting already and put into full force in some cases. Take, for example, this question of the policy that Trump recently enacted or wanted to enact, which federal judges have pretty much put a kibosh on for the moment, of preventing immigration from certain countries, six of them. These are Muslim-majority countries. It really was the ACLU and other groups. That's where the opposition came from, and it was effective. We have judges as recently as yesterday ruling that those new directives that Trump has ordered to go into effect immediately cannot be put into effect. So this is the second time he's been smacked down on that particular issue, but the impetus, the real battle was waged not by legislators. The real battle was waged by advocacy groups. And this is our ongoing problem and dilemma, because in the end, there has to be some mechanism that is legally authorized from a legislative point of view, legally authorized to do battle. Because these are things that involve changes in the law, changes in official legal policy. The outside groups are extremely important in shoring up support for certain changes and in confronting the administration. But in the end, there has to be, or there ought to be, some kind of organized system that takes on the battle within Congress. Now, as powerful as many of these outside groups and as effective as they have been, and thank goodness they have devoted themselves to taking on these battles, you know, Planned Parenthood and so forth, they're not inside. They're not inside the beast, as it were. They're not inside the belly of the beast. And so there is a natural limitation as to how far they can go in succeeding at this business of challenging the Trump policies or the intended policies. They can confront it through the courts. But I'm making the case that where the fight is going to be lost because we don't see the amassing of the kind of power, firepower that we need to actually put some of these policies just totally out of commission, we don't see the firepower with the Democrats. We don't. And if they are to take on an issue, in some cases, they'll have to almost start from scratch. You know, they don't have a ready-made a form of resistance in play. They just don't. The other parties that we could look toward themselves are not fully functioning. They're just not formed to the degree where they can cause certain kinds of legislation to be passed, where they can successfully and legally tackle legislation in Congress. They can't do it. They don't have the wherewithal to do that. So I'm coming back to our discussion, and we'll kind of wrap it up because after a while it would seem like I'm suggesting there's no hope, and I don't want to be communicating that. I'm saying, though, that we should get real about our position. Trump is able right now, even though the policies are kind of wacky and just in some cases so offensive. There's every reason to believe that there's a way to successfully challenge these policies he wants to implement. But the reality is we're just not ready. There's no sense that they're ready for a fight. And ready for a fight meaning that they will, once they engage, they more than likely will win. All along we've been seeing that in cases where there have been successful challenges, it's the people, we're doing the work, that the elected officials should be doing. The people have to come out into the street. Now, people would say, well, that too is part of the democratic process. Yeah, you could say that, but it's, of course, a wimpy argument. It's a thin argument. Because we should have in place by now some credible force that we can say, okay, our actions on the outside, the demonstrating, the various campaigns that people are taking and organizations are taking on, those are supposed to be ancillary. Those are supposed to be backup for the real action within Congress. But we're not seeing within Congress that the parties are able at this point to predictably produce a result. They're not fully formed yet. They're in disarray. They are weak. And it has to do with a lackluster leadership. It has to do with the fact that they got so comfortable being the people in charge that they didn't have to make too much of an effort, an extra effort, to make sure that their flanks were guarded. And that at any time they could mobilize and get the job done. They believed, I think, this is what I get from looking at the scenario, they believed that it was going to be a certain thing. It was a done deal that the Democrats will hold on to their power, that there wouldn't be very much of a challenge. I mean, Trump was a nut. You know, and people would respond appropriately and dismiss him as a kind of a nut. But he turned this whole thing upside down, and they were not ready. They were in stages of decay because they got very, very comfortable and didn't see the need to, guard their victories or their previous victories. They did not challenge even their Democratic leadership because, frankly, Barack Obama should have faced stiff censure. He should have come under some fierce attacks from within his own party. His policies, many of them, were just lethal. And some of them just plain stupid. His foreign policy record for the 8 years that he has been in office was just shameful in many ways. The Democratic Party, starting with Barack Obama, began to let down its guard, and in the process, it began to let down the people. So here we are with this awakening, the sudden awakening that, oh my God, we got to do something. Well, you have to do something, but you're in a state of disarray. You were ignoring all along the indications that you have to get on point. You have to be a credible opposition. But they just, you know, they were lollygagging. They were having a good time. They were safe. The apple cart was just not going to be upset. And they could continue feeling confident that they will continue to hold the reins of power. Well, here we are. The significant thing has been that it is the people, in the instances where victory has been scored, it's the people. So the question is, well, why do we need the Democratic Party? This is the dilemma we are now in, because the work that we can do, the influence that we can exert, is from the outside. Systemically, we're not saying very much, because the party is in such disarray. It is so powerless at this point. And if it is to be effective, it will now have to take on the double duty of rebuilding the party, which is going to take time and effort and money and many other things to just get it together, and then take on the Trump administration. And it can't do both at the same time. So no matter how we look at it, we're in a bad situation with respect to power and affecting political outcomes. We're in a bad way. The parties that could emerge in this time and should emerge in this time themselves are in a state of disarray. And they seem to have retreated since the election. And this is why I'm so critical of the Green Party in particular. It had an encouraging showing, and it should have immediately built upon it, immediately begun an aggressive outreach program that would bring people into it and that would fortify the party to be an effective defense. Because we need it. Let's face it. We need it. It is not about whether you agree 100% with any particular party. The idea is you have to develop some kind of strategy, because the bottom line, again, is you got to survive. This administration is proceeding, even with, you know, the challenges, the legal challenges that have set it back, it continues to proceed with its vision and its plans. And they're not that good. They're not good for the country. But they're good for the mentality. They're good for the vested interest of this administration to prove a point, to totally devolve this social, political, and economic system, to radically alter it. I mean, just yesterday, Donald Trump talked lovingly about Andrew Jackson being his hero. And then, you know, when you understand the enormity and implication of statements like that, you don't need much more information to anticipate what is in store. How are we going to fight? How do we fight this juggernaut? I mean, where is the firepower going to come from with a disabled and disorganized and weakened Democratic Party, with the Republicans controlling practically all levels of government, the White House, the Senate, the House of Representatives. It has the lion's share of governorships. They're not playing. They are not playing. And they are hell-bent on implementing all these retrograde policies, both domestically and internationally. This is, as I said, this is a very serious time. This is a very serious historical moment, because it's like the division between BC and AD. That's how dramatic it's going to be, and already is. So let's see if we can turn the corner here on this discussion, keeping in mind, and this is very important, Donald Trump and his administration literally have been assisted. This is going to be my charge. They've been assisted by Barack Obama. They've been assisted by the crazy policies, and in some cases, no policies of the Obama administration that could have, you know, at least provided some kind of a cushion, at least if only of time, before the Trump administration could get to untangle it. But the Obama administration's domestic and foreign policy record isn't all that pristine. So the Democrats had been fouling up for the last 8 years. What we are encouraged to believe is that Trump came out of the blue, of course, with this major political upset, and now he is starting to do these awful things in terms of policies. But he had a head start. He had a head start because the Democratic Party, under the Obama administration, did very little in some of these critical areas to set things straight. And in some cases, they fouled up big time. I just need to point out Libya. What Hillary Clinton did in Libya, the so-called policy of regime change, all these secret little wars that, you know, Obama has had this nation in a state of war for the 8 years he's been in office. He is not at all to be exempted from the predicament that we have. He, in many ways, laid the groundwork for it, whether by omission or commission. So we need to be really clear about that. It would be convenient for people to say, oh, Trump is doing this and Trump is doing that. Well, we always have to remember things just don't happen in a vacuum. There's precedence. There's context. So I'll leave it there as a kind of opener to guide our discussion today and see if we can get any closer to understanding the relationship between that Obama administration, the craziness that we are experiencing with the Trump administration, and what is the possible solution, the best solution at this time, because we definitely need protection. We need some kind of political cover. Where is it to be found? 888-874-4888 is the number to call. We'll take the short break and come back to your thoughts on the subject. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we try to turn the corner here on getting some clarity about where do we go? What do we do for political protection in the circumstances we find ourselves in? Where's it going to come from? How do we get it? What will have to happen? We see that President Trump has rolled out his preliminary budget. It is not particularly good news, especially for people who are poor and struggling. And we still don't know what the final result will be of that budget, but he's proceeding. He's proceeding with his vision and implementing his vision. So we have to accept it in that spirit. It is not final, but we still have to ask the question, when it does become final, will it become final with our input or without it? Would we be able to amend it? Will our representatives be able to amend this budget and other policies that reflect what we consider to be a shared agenda, a progressive agenda? Or is, you know, do we need to just cancel all of this stuff, cancel hope of any of this thing happening, and instead gird ourselves for a very, very rough patch for the next couple of years and see if in the meantime we can come up with something that approximates a logical response to what we inevitably will be facing. Domestic policies, foreign policies, we will have rough times with what is going to be put on the table. I'm just asking, you know, how are we prepared to fight? Because we have to fight. And this also goes to the personal level. There's the collective issue, but there's also the personal level. Because in the end, it comes down to policies and practices affecting us in our daily lives. What will we now have to prepare ourselves to face and be prepared for? And how are we going to get through it? I don't mean to sound alarmist or even fatalistic. I'm saying this is the reality. And we're not really getting much in the way of information about what we're supposed to do. What's a good way to tackle the immediate future? It's coming at us at 100 miles an hour. And what mechanisms do you think are salvageable or workable at this point to help us at least get some kind of a solid footing in these times that are to come? 888-874-4888. We're going to talk about this today and see whether we get any closer to a definitive assessment, a definitive decision about where we go. What do we do? It is a frightening moment in our history, and I think part of it is we don't want to really deal with it. You know, we tapped out. We don't want to deal with this stuff. This is annoying and it's frightening and it's very disconcerting. But it will not serve us to ignore it. We have to figure out something and we have to look at the problem squarely. It's a very complex problem that we face. And insofar as we, as they say, you know, we just have to get through it. The question is how. This should be our defining moment in terms of getting a handle on what our politics are or what we say that we want them to be. What we see how we see ourselves in political struggles or contributing to political struggles that have at front and center the welfare and goodwill of the people. Right now, okay, a budget has been released, a preliminary budget has been released, and the implication is so clear. Deal with it. Just deal with it. Trump and his people are prepared to fight, to preserve their so-called vision expressed in the budget. What are we doing? How can we resist this? What mechanisms do we have that could possibly be effective? And how are we situated individually and as part of some movement, some coordinated effort? Or are we seeing already, as we had talked about previously, there's every indication that people are kind of maybe tired, overwhelmed, intimidated, I don't know, but the action has dwindled. The action level has dwindled quite a bit. And that's not a good sign. It should be the other way around. But, you know, this is life. This is where we are. So how do we recoup some kind of protection here? And how do we take some degree of control over this administration and where it wants to take us all? How proactive could we get, and in what ways could we be proactive? Any ideas? I'm waiting to hear from you at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now, I know it's a pretty intimidating discussion to have. Because frankly, and this is something I think we share, we don't know. We aren't so clear as to what to do or where we go or how do we proceed in some kind of coordinated fashion to take on this administration. How do we safeguard our interests? How do we survive? This is the central question here. How do we survive? It is not just about reacting to a budget or reacting to a statement or reacting to some calamity caused by Trump himself. It is, as you know, a very complex thing. Our systems have been failing. And they have been failing spectacularly. They are very much damaged. They can't sustain this kind of fight. They have to first go through a period of rebuilding and recollecting themselves. So they're going to be out for a while. And besides which, they've reached a point of saturation, I think. They are unable to move in the way that the times should compel them to move. They're older. They're tired. They've been in Congress for a long time. They're thinking of retirement. They want out. They don't want to now begin a fierce battle because they can't sustain the fight. We see it. I mean, this is not, I'm not talking out of turn. We see what they're communicating to us. They have been depleted of their energy for all kinds of reasons. This is where they are brought to this point. And it is not easy to reconstitute themselves and wage a battle at the same time. We saw that recently when the leadership of the Democratic National Committee changed hands. We talked about it. Okay, so you changed hands in the middle of the storm, you changed hands, but there's no indication that there is support. There's no money. There's very little in the way of actual help being given the new folks who are reflections of the old folks. They're just one generation newer. But they subscribe to the same ways of thinking. And I'm not so sure that they can relearn how to do politics at this level. They can't do all of that at the same time. We on the outside, what are we doing? We clearly have allowed these burgeoning movements that people invested so heavily in, we're letting them slide. We're not demanding explanations from them about the performance in the 2016 election, the vision, and the strategy. There's no leadership being exercised here in terms of what we expect a non-mainstream party or movement to do. You have to gather up your folks. You have to give them a sense of direction. You have to lay out a plan. You have to let them see the vision. And you have to help equip them to do battle. This is not what they do. This is not their everyday job. You have to teach people. You have to bring them along if you mean to be relevant at all. And for the people themselves, we know that they're dancing on both sides of the fence, which is what life is all about. Trying to look to your personal interests because you must survive. Personal survival is at the top of the list. And you will need some kind of apparatus that reinforces the efforts that you're making to effect change on a wider level. So it's not a good time, but it is the time that we're in. And at some point, we ought to have or try to have an answer. Where do we go? How do we get this thing done? How do we let a system know that we do have the power and ability to put it in check? It's already indicated this is a runaway train. And to the amazement of just about everybody, this was not supposed to happen. Trump is not following the rules. And he has reinforced in his followers and supporters, he has reinforced values that are quite scary. But these values are important to them. When the man says, I mean, Andrew Jackson is my hero. And if you do a little reading, in fact, I recommend it, you do some reading about Andrew Jackson. And you see why he would be a hero to a Donald Trump and to Donald Trump supporters. You see it. There's no surprising detail here. Okay. So I gather, because we are waiting, but we haven't gotten any calls. So maybe you're thinking. So we have some time. If you wish to talk about something else, we'll do that and consider it our Free Your Mind Friday a little bit early. And we have some time left on this segment. And I was hoping that you would, since we've been on this topic for a couple of days, that we would finish it off today. But perhaps this is your way of saying, hey, we finished with this. Let's move on. So I say okay, too. So you can call 888-874-4888, and let's talk about what you want to talk about for the rest of the program. Okay? All right. So I wanted to also talk about the fact, and we have to keep it in mind, that we cannot leave Barack Obama out of the equation. Many of our issues that we'll be dealing with is a result of the continuity of problems, starting within the, not just even the Obama administration, but I'm saying Obama because he was the immediate past president, but going all the way back, the Clintons, we have a program coming up, a series of programs updating the Clintons. It's mind-boggling, the level of crime. It's just mind-boggling that has gone totally untouched, unprosecuted, uninvestigated. But we'll be dealing with that next week, a series of programs updating the devastation that the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation have had, especially in the black world. And major, major questions about criminality and the impact, why they selected certain countries to export their enterprises in. So we'll be talking about that. We also will be talking about some critical issues having to do with self-initiated projects. And it's time for people to get a little bolder and initiate your own project. Mohammed from Queens, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Good afternoon.
In regards to how we challenge the Republican Party, you know, this is a, how would you say, this is a very big job in a sense that first we have to educate a lot of people. We have to get them together, educate them, and organize them. And while we are doing that, we cannot forget these young people. We also need to inform these young people of what's going on, the dynamics, and prepare them to make the changes. You know, I've always worked on that as a, I guess you could say, a social worker and a psychotherapist working in the schools, you know. And what you do, you prepare them young for leadership skills, and you also work on building their character. Now, by that, when I say build their character, you need to give them things like faith, belief in themselves, what desire is, you know, what motivation is, things of that nature, and then prepare them, you know, to lead and come up. See, they're the ones that have the ideas and that's going to make the changes. It's not us, you know. And when I would talk like this, many people would always say, Sharif, we don't want to hear that mess, you know, Mohammed. And I would say, look, you two, for one thing, we can't use you. We don't even want your children. We want your grandchildren, someone fresh. But the key is organizing and informing the people of what's really going on. And I hate to say this, Eutrice Lee, but so many people are working so hard on two and three jobs like I was that they don't have time. I mean, I would catch Gary Noel when I could, and I would catch Amy Goodman. But many times while working, you know, I just didn't have the time for that, you know. But we do need to come together, hold the Green Party accountable, and think about forming some of our own parties, you know, to really work on solving these problems and get ready for the future. Thank you very much. I hope I've added something positive.
Oh, sure. I'm hoping, I mean, I would settle for just an awakening in people about this being, this aspect of life being essential as well. And this is part of what everybody ought to have some kind of familiarity with. a political outlook. When I say that, I don't mean running for office necessarily or any of that, but just the awareness of the political structure and system and its relationship to a person individually and its relationship to collective progress. What is the interplay between this system and where it is we think the society ought to go? What is to be permissible and what is not to be permissible? And to what degree do we have some degree of checks and balances with us being in that role? How do we do that? It's a re-education of our political consciousness is really what I'm saying.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll just go back. Utrecht, I'll say this, and I'm a little biased. You know, as a young teenager, I had the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. The first thing, and I think Socrates said this also, is knowing yourself. See, when you know yourself, I mean, I spent a lot of time in mental institutions, prisons, wound up being a psychotherapist and a school social worker. And Islam is what helped me turn my life around. And then when I came out, I was able to go back into prisons and mental hospitals. Somewhere I was a patient, and I would work with those people. But it's the insight, knowing who you are. Prior to my changing my life around, I wanted to be a gangster because I thought I couldn't learn. So once I had my history, I learned that from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Then I no longer wanted to be a gangster. I wanted to be myself. I wanted to be one of our people. And I wanted to help our people, and that's what I did for the next 40 years. And I was gifted with the understanding of how just to make things simple for the young people. Once they see they can learn, their attitudes change, and you get their ideas. Because, I mean, when I would work with my groups and work in the school, before I would define a concept, I'd always introduce it, and I would get their view on it. And I've researched my concepts before I went in there the night prior. Those people, children and the patients, they would come off the top of their head with better definitions that I had really come about through research. So everyone has something special and everyone can help out, but they need leadership.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who's rooting was within Garveyism.
Right.
And it was not just about a spiritual awakening, it was a total awakening. And that's the kind of political consciousness that I'm talking about. We have to develop a holistic view of ourselves and the role that we, at least theoretically, we could play in changing our society. Thank you so much for calling today, Muhammad. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for having
me. From the Bronx, April, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrecht. This is April.
Hello.
Hi. So one thing that I found really puzzling is that most of these Republicans are supposed to be Christians. And some of the things that they want to do to the poor, I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Well, they're not singular in this respect. You have a whole bunch of Christian Democrats destroying possibilities and potentials for people.
Correct. And you would think that the thing that they're supposed to be doing is trying to, if they're going to follow the Bible, to help the poor and to help those that are in need. And I think Kennedy, one of the representatives, was bringing that point out about showing love or something like that.
Well, what do you think is the reason that they, you know, they carp on this Christian theme so much? What is the use of it and the purpose of it?
I never thought about it. But I think back in the times, slave owners were Christians too.
Well, you know, it is said that in 1555, the first slaves were brought to the United States on a ship named Jesus. So we do have that kind of anomaly in our experience.
Correct.
But it is done really to, again, assert, and I mean, they're not hiding this, mm-hmm. that this, they're reforming the country, the psyche of the country, the attitude of the country. They're resituating the United States within the context of the world. So when they tell you that, you know, this, start talking about the Christian thing and slavery, most everybody was in the United States in the slave trade, and that includes so many presidents, including Donald Trump's hero, Andrew Jackson. Slavery and Christianity went hand in hand.
It's right. That's right. And I guess they're trying to, this is another form of slavery.
This is a way of saying we are recontextualizing. That's a big word, but it means that we are resituating this country as opposed to the Muslim world. We are the part of the Christian world.
Right.
And, you know, that is a signal to Donald, from Donald Trump to his supporters. You know, all the Klan's people, they were very, very devoted Christians.
Yes.
All of the horrible things were done by Christians.
Scary.
So they're sending the message that we're rebuilding and reconstituting our empire.
So and you ought to be part of it. If you're representing God, what would the devil do? what would the devil, if this is God?
What would the, if this is a reflection of godly values,
exactly.
What would the devil do, I tell you? But that's really what it is. It's part of the psyche, to reconstitute the American psyche and to provide, because if you can't figure it out, they give you the answer that you are part of a Christian nation. And you need to understand that, and you need to uphold Christian values. And then it has its ripple effects. You have Christian values in your schools. You will soon have Christian values applied to your job, Christian values even to get an apartment. You know, are you a Christian? Yeah. They're resituating the country within the context of this dynamic that we... But in other words, if you are Christian, you are against Islam. You are against Buddhism and all those so-called fake religions.
But they're against people that are poor, too, when it should be you're helping the poor.
Yeah, it should be helping the poor. But they rationalized that a long time ago.
Yeah, they
And they gave people an out.
Pizza.
They said the poor will always be with us.
Be amongst you, that's right.
There you go.
Wow.
So you don't need to feel especially bad if you find yourself having to deal with poor people. You know, you don't need to get especially exercised about it. The poor will always be with us.
Especially if we're in charge.
And if they were good Christians. Now, if they were good Christians, they would trust that God will provide a better day for them. They're good Christians. Accept your poverty and pray and praise God.
Wow.
Is that not true?
So much. It's true.
Yeah. Accept your poverty and praise God.
Wow.
That's a good Christian right there. Thanks so much, April, for calling
in. Thank you.
A delight to talk with you today. And that brings us to the end of the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You could reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll join each other tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.